Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am Justin Landon, and I do believe we are officially into season two, if there were such a thing in podcast land. But there is no such thing as season two. We're just in episode something or rather. I'm here tonight with author Mike Cole. Mike is the author of four novels, including Control Point, Fortress Frontier, and Breach Zone, which completed the Shadow Ops trilogy. His fourth novel, Gemini Cell, comes out on January 27th from Ace Books. Mike is a U.S. Coast Guard officer and has been deployed overseas and domestically on several occasions. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I just want to make a point. You know, I said that you'd completed your Shadow Ops trilogy.
Thank you for noting that.
And although it should be noted up front, the Gemini Cell is set in the same world, but it's a totally different ball of wax.
Yeah, it takes place many, many years before Control Point with a completely new line of characters. But the goal here was to do something new enough that if people didn't want to read any of my other novels and start in my universe here, this is the book for them, but also for fans of the original trilogy to have something that they could sort of set their feet on the ground of my universe and say, hey, I know that.
See, now we hear that a lot from authors. I mean, you hear this all the time, right? It's a classic author cliche, which just says, well, I wrote this new book, and yeah, you can read it on its own without the other books, and sometimes they're full of shit.
No, that is not the case here. This really has zero to do with the timeline and characters of the original trilogy. The magic system is almost so different to be a different magic system, although you'll see hints of how it ties into the magic system in the Shadow Ops trilogy. It really is a new story. I'm inspired by Joe Abercrombie in this. I don't know how many of your listeners are big Joe Abercrombie fans. He's an amazing writer, one of my favorites in the genre. And he had his first law trilogy, which was hugely successful. And then he followed it up with three more novels, all set in the same universe that followed ancillary characters from that first law trilogy in their own stories, in their own adventures. And so they were sort of, I mean, they're chronologically in sequence, but they're not really in series. And I love that idea of standalone books that played with the same universe. And I absolutely felt like I was getting the same, whatever sensation I was looking for when I read First Law in these other books. And I really wanted to do something like that. Plus, like, I really feel that people who are successful in the arts, they do it by taking risks and doing things that are different. And the book after book after book after book in series has really been done to death. And if you notice in my Shadow Ops trilogy, I have a different protagonist for each novel. That's by design. I'm trying as hard as I can to push the envelope, keep the series commercially viable, but also take risks.
It's interesting you bring up Joe Abercrombie, and unfortunately, I think Joe Abercrombie should be paying this podcast some sort of like fee every time his name is mentioned, because he's mentioned every episode, which I'm sure no shortage of listeners find incredibly annoying, but the truth is he's actually very good at what he does. You know, I've just started the third book in his First Law trilogy for, I don't know, the fourth or fifth time, and I'm doing the reread for Tor.com, and of course I've read, you know, everything he's published to date, and the interesting thing about him is he's been very successful, but every single book gets better. The challenge, of course, for him is, though, and the challenge is the same for you, and obviously your goal is to be getting better with each book, and I think you're accomplishing that, but your readers are not always at the same place you're at, right? Their opinion of you is formed by the first book they read, which is, in this case, Control Point.
Right.
And I think if you look at your reviews, generally Control Point is your worst reviewed of all your books.
Yep. And rightly so. I mean, I'll take it. It's a first novel. And I've said this in a lot of different interviews. I achieved with Control Point what I was trying to do artistically, which was to create a military lead who did not fit the military tropes of being confident, of being, you know, certain, of being brave, who was incredibly flawed, just like real human beings are incredibly flawed. And I feel very satisfied with that artistic choice and with how I achieved it. What I'm not satisfied with is that when you write a narrative where people hate the main character so much that they don't want to read more Mike Cole books, then you're losing audience. And that's not cool. That's not a thing I can have. And I believe fixed that with Alan Bookbinder in Fortress Frontier and fixed it very well. But, you know, the one of the things I'd love to see Gemini Cell do is for readers who had read Control Point and been like, yeah, man, Oscar Britton is way too wishy-washy. I don't want to read any more Mike Cole. Let me, you know, this looks different. Maybe he's turned over a new leaf. Let me give this one a shot. Because James Schweitzer, the protagonist of Gemini Cell, is about as different from Oscar Britton as night is from day.
And a lot of that goes back to something that I think is classic in literature, which is and it's, I think it's become more of an in vogue term recently. I don't know if it's something we've used in literature for a long time. We talk a lot about agency, and usually it's being deployed, that term is being deployed with relation to women or minorities in books who've typically not have a lot of agency, which means they often haven't been given hero stuff to do or haven't made the decisions that alter the course of the narrative within a text. And I think the negative reaction to Oscar Britton, which you sort of hinted at, is that he's reactionary. Like he mm-hmm. is not often taking the bull by the horns. He's letting other people drag him around to some mm-hmm. degree and unwilling to make the hard decisions.
And letting his own baggage drag him around. Right. He's petulant. He's confused. He's flailing. And he's all of those things. And by design. No, you're absolutely right. I think agency is an accurate assessment of what the problems people have with that character are. And there are, but the thing is, as I read other writers, and Joe's a good example of this, but Mark Lawrence is an excellent example of this as well. You know, Jorg Ankrath, who's the protagonist of his Broken Empire trilogy, is totally driven by his demons and is absolutely dragged around by his rage, by his petulance, by his need to posture. But Lawrence pulls it off, and he pulls it off in a way I was unable to with Oscar Britton. I've gotten better at doing it in later novels, but this is why this is what you said about stealing liberally from your friends. You know, Jorg Ankrath is a character. I even wrote a whole blog post about him and what he means to me that I've always looked to as an example of how a character can be flawed and flailing, but still be incredibly compelling.
Well, I'll reference another writer, which is Cameron Hurley and her first trilogy.
The Beldam Apocrypha.
The Beldam Apocrypha, starting with the book God's War. The following two books, Infidel and Rapture, which unfortunately not a lot of people read due to the Nightshade collapse, but they're excellent. But the main character in that series is Nyx, and she's a bounty hunter mm-hmm. and totally unlikable. She's a rancid human being mostly. She spends most of the novel cutting people's heads off and doing all kinds of horrible things, much like some of the other characters we've just talked about. And yet, she's actually really compelling as a protagonist, and you really want to be part of her story because she's incredibly proactive. And it's sometimes it's bizarre to me that it can be that easy to hook a reader's attention, but sometimes it really just is having somebody that grabs things and goes after them. And I think both Alan Bookbinder, Harlequin in book three, and then James Schweitzer in this new book, all of them are driving the story with their own sort of sense of will. I would point out, it's not just James Schweitzer, this military wrecking ball. It's also his wife.
Yeah, Sarah Schweitzer. And this was something that I've also felt the sting from critics in previous books. Is I actually had someone accuse me of being a misogynist in a review because of my quote unquote failure to give women enough POV screen time in the novels. And, you know, of course, your first reaction when you read something like that is, this guy doesn't know me at all, and to get sort of self-righteous and defensive. But then you calm down, you think about it, and you're like, well, do I really have female POVs? Am I really thinking about how to write, you know, female voices authentically and to really make them resonate in my work? And the answer is, I could do better. And I introduce the POV of the antagonist Scylla in Breach Zone, which was really cool to write and really fun to explore that character. And with Sarah Schweitzer, it was my first real, you know, she's almost a main character of the novel. I mean, she gets almost as much screen time as James Schweitzer does. And writing from her POV was a huge growth experience for me as a writer, and I'm really, really glad I did it. One of the things I've said a lot too in interviews is, I'm really, really proud of the fact, like, I can't say whether my books are good or not, and I try to be honest about where they fail. But what I can say, and I think this is an objective truth, is that every single one of them is different from the other one. I really am pushing what I can do with each one, and I really am not rubber stamping the same books out over and over again. And you know, my career may succeed or my career may fail, but that is definitely a point of pride for me.
Yeah, I know every agent and editor out there advises their authors to write something different every time.
I'm sure I give my agent fits. And I'll tell you, look, my editor at Penguin, when I turned in, Penguin Random House, when I turned in Fortress Frontier, and it wasn't the same protagonist, my editor was like, there was a brief moment where you could sort of hear the editorial offices over there at Ace Rock being like, what is he doing? They were hip to it by the time I handed in the manuscript for Breach Zone. But there was definitely a moment where they were like, this is not Oscar Britton, this is someone else.
And this gets back to the whole notion of series fiction, and how for forever and ever we've been pigeonholed into this idea of trilogies and long run series. And certainly Ace Rock has had huge success with things like, Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden books and
Patricia Briggs.
Sure. There's dozens of them that they've had, Jack Campbell and others who they've had huge success with. Yeah. And then, of course, you've had long running series like, Terry Goodkind's sort of truth series is on like book 20 and Piers Anthony and all these other writers that have been writing in the same worlds for decades. Ellie Modisette.
That sounds like hell to me. I can't stand that. The thought of that gives me an anxiety attack. Maybe I don't have the long enough attention span, but and this is one of the reasons why I'm working on other projects outside the military milieu. I'm absolutely, as long as people are willing to give me contracts to write military fantasies in the Shadow Ops universe, I will. But it's very important to me for my career to have some breadth and depth. And this is one of the reasons why I admire Jim Butcher so much, is that everybody says Harry Dresden, Harry Dresden, Harry Dresden. But the Codex Alera is a medieval fantasy that he did that's quite successful. And Brandon Sanderson is another writer who has his Allomantic series. He has Elantris. He has now Warbreaker. He has his Alcatraz and the Evil Librarian series. Like, he's prolific, but he's also extremely diverse. And that's got to be really, really great for him creatively.
Sure helps when you can write a 30,000 word novella, on a plane trip.
Nobody knows how he does it.
That's a superpower. For sure. You've put an emphasis on writing a woman as a primary POV. And you have written women as POV before, but not a primary. And we talk about this a lot at various points, and there have been some blog posts written recently, and I won't go into too much detail. We'll get a little controversial if I do, so I won't. But there have been some blog posts written recently about not wanting to write things that are sort of outside our experience level, and I don't want to write. I don't know what it's like to be a woman, so I'm not going to write one.
It scared the crap out of me, Justin. I won't lie. It's funny. I was just interviewed on the Graphic Audio. I went down to Graphic Audio to record the voice of one of my characters for an audio drama they're doing of Control Point, in fact. And the guy who is the narrator and the director for the for that project is African-American. And when we were in the booth and he was interviewing me, he asked me point blank. He was like, "You wrote an African-American character. Were you worried about getting the voice right?" And I told him, "Yeah, I was worried about getting the voice right. I'm petrified about getting the voice right and being accused of trying to speak on a topic that I know nothing about, or coming across as insulting or just clueless." And I said, "Yeah, that scared the crap out of me. But again, like, this is art and you have to take risks. And Oscar Britton's character was African American, and I couldn't write him any other way, and I had to try." And it's the same thing with Sarah Schweitzer. It scared the crap out of me. I wrote a sex scene from her point of view, which was this incredible growth experience for me, because I realized that, I'm over 40 years old and I have never really sat down and thought about how women experience sex. Really like the mechanics of it. And, as a writer, that's a really serious failing. And, it was incredibly difficult and petrifying and scary. But again, like, who dares wins? Like, I may get it wrong and I may be smacked down by the reading population. I'm sure I'm going to get hostile reviews. But it's important to me to at least say that I tried, I pushed my boundaries of what I could do as a writer. And, I don't want to sound like a Hallmark card, but I actually feel like I'm a better person for the experience.
Sex scenes in general are a challenge, I think. Yeah. If I recall correctly, this is the first time you've written a sex scene, or at least you've written one of any substance. I think the ones, if there was anything previous. Oh, you did write one with Scylla and Harlequin in Breach Zone, if I'm not mistaken.
Not as detailed by a long shot as this one, or the one even at the beginning of one with Schweitzer and his wife at the beginning of Gemini Cell. I didn't provide any details. And I'm not a guy who talks a heck of a lot about sex, so it was definitely hair raising, frightening. Like, I was, worried about getting it wrong. And the thing is, at the time I was writing the scene, I'm single, right? So at the time I was writing the scene, I was single. So who do I ask? Who do you go to sit down and say, "Hey, I've never had sex while being a woman. So what does that feel like? Like, what is physically going on in your body, and what is going on emotionally, and where is it happening, and how do you feel, and what do you want to happen, and what don't you want to happen? There's no way to have that conversation without coming across as a total creeper. I'm not going to have that conversation with my mom. I'm not going to have that conversation with any of my relatives. Most of my female friends are publishing professionals. So if that conversation goes wrong, you know, you've just, you know, creeped out someone in your own field. So like, I was really, really worried about what to do. And finally, I cornered Carrie Vaughn, who's, she does the Kitty series, at a party. I think it was at, Worldcon San Antonio. And I basically just said, look, I've never had sex while being a woman before. I don't have anyone else I can ask. I feel moderately comfortable with you. Please read this. And just, you don't have to even give me details if that makes you uncomfortable. Just tell me if it comes across as off to you. And I'm very, very fortunate that she said she would.
Asking for a friend. I think that's the best way to approach these kinds of things. You know, just asking for a friend.
I lack even that much guile. Look, I mean, I definitely know what I don't know, and I try to be honest about my failures. And I still don't feel like I know very much, but I know a little more now than I did.
So I would say, you know, having read all of your published novels, and having read a lot of other novels in my time, I would actually feel like I could call Gemini Cell and elements of Breach Zone in some way, but definitely more with Gemini Cell, that you have strong elements of actual romance.
Yes.
It's not just an action novel. It's not just a fantasy novel. There are absolutely elements of actual, genuine romance.
And that's very gratifying to hear, because that's also by design. I think that, like, there's really two things that human beings – I mean, there's only one thing interesting in stories, and that's other people. And there's really two things of other people that are really, really fascinating for a narrative, and that's sex and violence. And that's why you see so much of both and the extrapolations of those, romance and, you know, the violent associations of adventure and war. And I think I was galvanized to this because – years ago, and I think I told you about this, I was visiting with Mindy Klasky, who's a, a romance writer, among many other things. And we were talking about category romances. And all of these books on the cover had these men in military uniforms, you know, these square-jawed, buzz-cut men. And I was sort of like, well, that's, you know, sort of what I look like, you know, so I feel like I'm represented in these books. Who's writing them? You know, who are the guys who are writing them? And she was like, well, you know, men can't write this stuff. So what do you mean men can't write this stuff? She goes, well, you know, they do sometimes, but they always do it under a pseudonym because publishers won't publish it if it's under a male name. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, are you kidding me? And she wasn't. And when I started talking to my romance editor friends, I found out that that was true. This is like the bad old days of science fiction and fantasy. If you remember, Robin Hobb, Andre Norton, Friedman, like these women all deliberately chose male or a gender neutral name so that they could, you know, get their work published in this male only marketplace. How is it any more acceptable for the opposite to happen in romance? And I sort of decided that I was going to write romance and, you know, in a big huff puff. And Lauren Gilman, who used to edit for Harlequin and has written for Harlequin, was like, all right, Mike, that's well and good. You want to take over this genre that you know nothing about. Great. But you have some reading to do. You need to learn the genre. And I wound up reading a lot of romance in this sort of crusade, which I still feel and hope that one day I'll get it done when I, you know, once I satisfy all my book contracts. What I was really surprised was I expected The Bodice Ripper. I expected these breathy, awfully written books, and I was absolutely wrong. A lot of them were really amazing, and I really think it made me a better writer.
So I recently wrote a post for the Book Smugglers for their annual Smugglevus, which is their December celebration of writing. Totally tongue-in-cheek, an open letter to dude bros, you know, suggesting a way for them to improve themselves. And, you know, dude bros are always into systems on how to pick up chicks. So I said, here's a system on how to not be a douchebag. And the system was 10 steps, and it included reading a romance novel. And there's lots of fun little steps that are both comedic and enlightening, including some recommendations of what to do with their Axe body spray. But I used Courtney Milan's novel, The Duchess War, which is a historical romance.
Sure.
And there's no action per se, and, you know, as you would term it, action adventure. Like, there's none of that in the book. It's a romance about two people who are generally good people, who want to do the right thing, who don't hurt each other, who respect one another's boundaries, and yet she's able to create this immense amount of tension, not around negative ways they treat one another, but about how society and culture stand in the way of right. two good people coming together. Right. And when you think about it that way, it sounds boring, but it's not. Like,
no, it's not.
It's incredible how much tension is created in this. And I think, and I'm now leading the crusade as I think you are, of saying that, you know, the romance genre has a lot to share. And I think that science fiction and fantasy could learn a lot from a storytelling perspective about what's going on in those books. And I mean, obviously a lot of writers that are doing it today understand it, but there are a lot that don't.
And there's plenty of romance novels that have, I mean, if you must have violence to get something out of your romance, then, you know, Diana Gabaldon's Outlander. I mean, that book was as satisfying to me as George R. R. Martin's A Game of Thrones. And it has had almost parallel levels of success. And the seed of, I don't know if you've ever read Bernard Cornwell, but Bernard Cornwell is one of the most well-known historical fiction novelists of all time. His Richard Sharp series, which is about the Napoleonic Wars, the kernel of every single one of Sharp's incredibly violent, you know, wartime adventures surrounds a woman and his relationship with a woman. And so is his Thomas of Hookton series, which is about an archer who's sort of stranded in France after the Battle of Agincourt when the British rampaging free companies go home. But all of it surrounds romance. And I mean, look, the reality of it is that romance is one of the biggest driving forces in human life. And it's one of the biggest driving forces in not just for females, but for males as well. And I'm speaking from the perspective of myself as a cisgender heterosexual. You know, we are 50% of a romantic equation. We have an interest in sex. We have an interest in love. We have an interest in marriage and all of those things. And it makes a part of a compelling narrative. And I don't understand why it's sort of been walled off into a separate genre. And I can't stand being told by the publishing industry what it is I should read, you know, when I should read it. And this idea that romance is not a suitable genre for me just makes me want to read it all the more. And when I do read it and I realize, you know what, this is perfectly fine for everybody. I guess I want to upend that a little bit, which is why I tried to put it in my own work.
Talking about this from a very male point of view, like, sure. Flip it around, you think about Grimdark, right? You know, the Mark Lawrence and the Luke Skull and these other, you know, really grimdark writers. And you could see then from the opposite perspective where people like Cameron Hurley, well, I can write that too. And so, yep. you know, they're really pushing that envelope. You know, why should that be something that's only male readers and only
I get my head ripped off every time I say this. I hold to this day that the Fitz and Fool series by Robin Harb is grimdark.
Yeah.
That is some bleak, bleak stuff. And it starts bleak, it goes bleak, and it ends bleak. And it has that lovely little touch of redemption, but it's bleak as hell. And I absolutely think that it's grimdark.
So we've mentioned a lot of authors here as we've been talking. And I've heard you talk rather extensively at various times about good writing, about what makes good writing. In fact, we were on a panel, you were on a panel in Balticon a few years ago, and it was about prose and about good prose and what prose can accomplish and when to use, you know, florid prose versus more workman prose. And you read a passage from China Mieville, which, you know, it aroused everybody in the room for some reason. Because, you know, China's a great wordsmith. And we also know that, like, there's, you know, some things are just good stories, you know, whether they're, you know, and I think Brandon Sanderson can be a great example of that. You know, he's a great storyteller, even if his prose is not always the most sparkling, like, the man just tells a great story.
Right.
But a lot of times we see all these different things in books where we're sort of like, this book is objectively doing this well, or this book is doing this objectively poorly. And yet, we still find ourselves either turned off or sucked into the book, regardless of what it is objectively doing well. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges as a reader who reads critically, and I beta read for a lot of authors, and I'm always trying to pinpoint, like, what's working about this book? And sometimes I don't know. Sometimes it just feels like there's a magic sauce, a secret sauce, in books that we just can't put our fingers on. Do you experience that as well?
Yes. But the thing is, like, that secret sauce is in everything. You'll hear business people talk about, you know, Steve Jobs that way. Well, you know, he had this certain undefinable quality, or, you'll hear pilots, like, you know, great combat pilots talk about other pilots and say, you know, like, he just had that certain special something. I don't know how he did it, but he just did. And everybody always speculates about it. And it's like the idea of talent. And people have heard me talk about this before, is that, you know, I know that a couple of things can contribute to an artist's ability to create a great work. Some of it could be talent, which is this thing I can't quantify, right? And can't control. And some of it is focused practice. Well, the focused practice I can look at, I can quantify it, I can repeat it, I can see what is being done, I can break down mechanics. So what, I mean, talent may be a nice thing for you and I to talk about over beers at a con bar, but it's otherwise completely useless. Like, it doesn't do, if I can't control it and I can't quantify it, and there's really not a lot of point in speculating about it, you know, other than idle speculation. I'm interested in what I can take from. And who knows, you know, maybe this is overly pragmatic and utilitarian of me, but I'm interested in what I can take from, you know, if I look at a great work of writing that really inspires me, like any of the writers we mentioned, Peter Brett, George R. R. Martin, Joe Abercrombie, what is it they're doing that I can imitate? What is it they're doing that I can reproduce in my own work to make my own work better? And that special secret sauce maybe it's there, but like, I can't do anything with that. And this is the thing when you get into the arts too, is that so much of the arts is subjective. You don't need me to remind you that 50 Shades of Grey is one of the most successful books of all time. And I refuse to bash books that I haven't read. But I mean, have you read 50 Shades?
I've read a bit of it.
All right. So, I mean, I hate bad mouthing books, but like, I didn't think that was very good. You know, I don't know if you had a different reaction from what you read.
No, I did not find it to be a pillar of literary achievement. However, and I had the same experience with Twilight, which I would classify in much the same way, I can see what snares people, right? Like, that book had a story that was interesting to people. That wasn't really interesting to me, because I couldn't really identify with what was going on. But I can see why there is a large segment of readers that found something interesting in those characters. Now, whether the writing sucked or the structure sucked, if you can identify if something in that book resonates with you, and Twilight's a great example, it obviously resonated with young women, and some young men as well. It captured something in those people. I don't know what. I don't know how, but it did.
Yeah, I mean, my point being is that the arts are subjective, right? And In a subjective system, I'm never going to be able to resonate with everybody all the time. And I have to, you know, take what I can and leave the rest. So yes, do I think there's some kind of special secret sauce? Absolutely. And that's certainly been my experience with some things. I've had that experience where I would say, I can't tell you why I love this, but I do. Oh, wow. I'm having that experience right now. So I favor really, workmanlike prose. We've had this conversation. And I don't like whimsical narratives. And I like things to be, I like extremely structured plots, that I like clip narratives, things that move quickly. I like hardbound rules in my magic system, right? So Neil Gaiman is basically my literary antichrist. I read Stardust. I read American Gods. Like, Neil Gaiman loves this numinous magic where there's no real set rules. He loves this sort of like sprawling universe where everything's kind of whimsical and fanciful and nothing is hard bounded. He will go on flights of fancy with his prose where you're basically almost reading a poem. And I'm rereading the Sandman trades now. Did you ever read that? This graphic novel?
I've heard they're wonderful, but
they really are. They really are. And like, I'm reading this and I can tell you everything I shouldn't like about it. Because it breaks all of my rules, and I'm doing air quotes here. It's all of those things that Gaiman does, and I'm friggin' hooked. I have burned through the first four trades. I can't wait to get to the fifth one. Again, this is that secret sauce. I don't know what he's doing, Justin, and I could probably sit down and hammer at it with you for hours and not be able to tell you exactly what he was doing, but he's doing it. He's really doing it.
Now, I heard Sam Sykes say something, and I don't often credit Sam Sykes with saying smart things, but this was smart, and he said that the thing that he looks for the most, that he identifies in a book, is when he can tell that the author is having fun with what they're writing, and that they are really, truly enjoying what they're putting down on the page. Now, that's a tough statement to make, because I don't think any author would sit at their computer typing there and saying, like, I loathe this story, I hate every single sentence that I'm writing. Like, obviously that doesn't happen very often. Generally, an author is writing something that they're passionate about and have and think is great and wonderful, at least in theory. But I think there's something to be said for the fact that when you can tell when an author is really in love with what they're doing.
Yes, and I've had that. Although I do want to caveat this by saying that Breach Zone, I had a really good time writing Gemini Cell. Gemini Cell really came easily to me and was fun. Breach Zone, it was like pulling teeth out of my skull. I hated that book. I was stuck on that book. I was not enjoying writing that book. Even the parts that flowed a little easier for me, I didn't enjoy. And if you just look at the critical reception of the book, it's considered my best. So you can have that experience of hating what you're writing and still be competent, which is where, I guess, workmanship comes into it, and the sort of showing up every day and treating writing like a trade and not an art.
So basically what we've come down to is there's no answers to this particular question.
I think what we've come down to is there is something there. Just like, I mean, people can prove that focused practice is not the only thing that makes somebody good at something. There is something to be said for talent or natural ability. I guess my point is that the things you can't quantify and the things you can't control are not things that, when you're trying to improve your own work, are worth a lot of time focusing on.
All right, so I have another question for you. This is a big what if, pie in the sky question. I just think it's fun. You found yourself in this situation where you wrote a book and published it. And since then, you've gotten better with each book, and you've made an effort to get better with each book, and it's paid off. That's great. You know, your books have steadily improved. What would you rather have, that? Or, you know, I'm thinking of a writer who, you know, their first book, it just crushes, right? I mean, it's the best thing that was ever written. Aaron Morgenstern's a great example of who wrote The Night Circus, which I think is a wonderful novel and beautifully written and all these things. It's a real achievement. Apparently it was written as a NaNoWriMo novel, and that she then edited and made better. But that was published 3 years ago, I think. And basically haven't heard anything from her since. And she's been fairly public on social media about the struggle with living up to those expectations. And that was a big hit, had a movie deal out of the gate and all this stuff. What's next? You know, and how do you live up to that? And how do you continue? And it's possible that she'll never write anything that good again, or at least nothing that's ever that well received again. And I listened to Patrick Ness the other day on my Tor.com sister show, Midnight in Karachi by Mavesh Murad. She interviewed Patrick Ness, who wrote A Monster Calls, which was a huge success and is currently in production for a film. And she asked him, you know, what's your favorite novel? And of course, his answer that you've written, of course, the answer was one that nobody else likes. Yeah, the one that everybody thinks is my worst book is the one that I think is the best. And but there's, as you look at those two scenarios, I mean, where would you rather be?
I want the best of both worlds, right? I mean, I want to have that huge success, and then I want the book that comes out after it to be huger still. I just feel like so much of writing has to be, it's really important that writers in general, I think, and myself in particular, avoid this idea of a muse and avoid this idea that, like, you know, sometimes it's flowing and sometimes it ain't, you know, like, yeah, maybe, but in the end, the only thing you can control is the work. It's the only thing you can control. And that much, it may mean that you're going to sit in front of that screen and sweat and bleed. And this is the reason why writing Breach Zone and just being stuck on it and having a terrible time with it was so instructive to me. And I'm really glad I had that experience, even though it was so hard going through it, is that I now know when I get stuck on a book that there ain't nothing to it but to do it. So I'm not really answering your question, but I'm going to twist it, you know, and you're asking me, would I rather have this breakout success up front, or would I rather slowly build to success? And I guess my answer is I'd rather have the breakout success up front and then still improve with every book, because I do think it's possible. Peter Brett is a perfect example of it. The Warded Man was a huge blockbuster when it first came out, and each book has been more successful and better written than the last. I'm trying to think of other examples of this. Naomi Novik did that, I think. His Majesty's Dragon was a pretty big hit when it first came out, and she built on that.
The other reality is those are two fairly small numbers of people, and the vast majority of writers in the field, in the world, are maybe neither of those things. I mean, they may be getting better with their craft, but they're not seeing really any change in direction. And, you know, they just sort of have these books that have been coming out every year for, you know, 25 years. And, a great example is Elizabeth Baer, who's written, I think, like 25 novels. I mean, something absurd like that. And 70 or like 120 published short stories. I mean, something just absurd. And I think she's brilliant. I mean, I think her work
she's gotten incredible acclaim.
Yeah, I mean, critically been a huge success, but has never really broken out commercially. And this is sort of the reality of science fiction and fantasy, is that there's a there's so few writers that are really finding tremendous success. And Jim Hines, an author with Daw, and he's self-published some work, is very public about his income, and publishes his income on an annual basis. And I think everybody in the industry thanks him for it, because it sort of gives some insight into what's really going on. But the truth is that writing is a challenging existence, because so few people can actually make a living doing it. And a couple episodes ago, we had your girlfriend on, Mallory O'Meara. Yeah. She's awesome. She's the communications director for Dark Dune Productions. And we talked a little bit about what it's like to live with a writer and with the pressures of being a writer and all of these things. And generally, she made it sound like a far rosier picture than most people talk about on Twitter about being a writer, living with a writer. But I'm curious about your perspective in this existence that we talk about just the struggle of writing, knowing that it's unlikely to ever just be a career, right? It's always going to be this other love that you do. And how you fit that into your life, and how you deal with your relationships and all
that. It's problematic. It really bugs me. And the amazing thing with Mallory is that Mallory has a regular job, but she's in a creative industry, is that she's making movies, and she works from home. So I get to see the sort of freedom that's in her schedule, and I get to see her. You know, I'm with the police department during the day, so I'm sort of dealing with a lot of stuff that I'd rather not be doing. Look, I love police work, but it's if I could, you know, make enough money as a full-time writer, then I definitely would in a heartbeat. So I'm able to sort of see that flexibility she has in her own lifestyle and think, man, you know, if I could only get back to that. Now, the thing is, I was a full-time writer, Justin, for several years, and I about lost my mind, because the feeling of flying without a net, of living, and I was okay. I stayed in the black. I lived like a college kid. I lived in a bad neighborhood. I ate ramen noodles. I mean, the whole nine. And I just couldn't stand it. I could not stand this constant feeling of, I don't know how I'm going to make rent next month. I don't know if I have a major medical expense or if my computer breaks, how I'm going to get through it. You know, I'm going to go on a date, but like, I'm going to have to ask this date of mine to split the bill with me. My mom's in town. And I can't afford to take my own mother out to dinner. It really ate away at me, and I handled it incredibly poorly. And one of the hard realizations I had is that I've got to feel safe. I've got to feel a net underneath me. I've got to feel like I'm a gentleman of property and standing, whatever that means. And when I went back into the workforce and was fortunate enough to get picked up by the police department, it made things a lot easier. I was able to enjoy writing a lot more, because when I look at my royalty statements now, you know, and I do by science fiction and fantasy standards, I do really well. And the money that I make writing affords me a very nice lifestyle when you add it to the money I already make with the police. But it enables me to have fun. It enables me to play around. It enables me to be a lot more honest. It enables me to be a lot less anxious and a lot less obsessive about my own numbers and how my success goes. But at the same time, it's super frustrating. A lot of my friends are successful writers that do it full time. I'm friendly with Kevin Hearn. I'm friendly with the whole Taco Church crew. It's Wesley Chu, Jason Huff. I'm also friendly with Peter Brett. These are all people, Scott Lynch, even Elizabeth Baer, through by living in rural Massachusetts. These are all people who have been able to write full time. And I do dream about it. And it does get frustrating. And whenever I'm dealing with some ridiculous, you know, law enforcement matter where I'm stuck on a job, you know, for 12 hours and it's, you know, 20 degrees outside or something, or I'm, you know, dealing with at a meeting with some city official who just is completely clueless and they're nattering on. And I'm thinking, my God, if I could just be my own boss, if I could just be a full-time writer again. But it's like I said about Breach Zone, I'm really glad I had that experience of sort of breaking down and having to cope with that anxiety, because now I know that I can't go back there until the level of writing success I enjoy is, I mean, really, I would have to make ridiculous, by science fiction and fantasy standards, I would have to be one of the major authors in the field to make enough money for me to feel comfortable quitting my day job.
Well, we're going to have to just make sure then the Gemini Cell is a runaway success.
Yes, yes.
And,
thank you.
We'll see if we can make that happen. People should definitely go out and get it. I think it's your best work yet. Congratulations. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
All right, this has been Rocket Talk.